Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. This is the Rose, Rose Colombo, right here for you on Colombo Chronicles Live. All shows are archived, so you can always come back. Scroll on down to your favorite topic, your favorite author, expert, and listen at any time at your convenience. Tired of television? Tune on some excellent information by the world's authors and experts. Just about on any topic you can even imagine, and including today, we'll be talking about science fiction. We are honored to have a returning guest, the award-winning 30th century sci-fi book series author, Mark Kingston Levin, Ph.D. Dr. Levin is the author of a trilogy, and he's got his first book is out, award-winning, Irwin Award-winning for the best science fiction book of the year, 30th Century Escape. He'll talk to us about that. His popular book number two, 30th Century Revived, and his up-and-coming book, he will announce coming soon, is 30th Century Contact. He's also going to talk to us about time travel, something I've always been fascinated with. Many people even say that they've been able to experience time travel, even though in our heads it's difficult to believe. Let's find out if that's possible in today's world, because so many things are happening so quickly and there's so much advanced technology, heaven only knows what's true and what's fiction. I'm going to tell you a little more about Mark Kingston Levin, Ph.D., our very special guest, who will be entering into the world of authors and experts in just a little while. And he worked on both the Apollo and Mars missions. He studied under Nobel laureate Paul Dirac. He obtained his Ph.D. in quantum mechanics in only 2.5 years. Remarkable. He has been published over 44 times in the scientific literature, and Dr. Levin founded two companies, and he was awarded over 32 patents. He retired in 2014 to apply his ideas about science, technology, space, and human relationships to the writing of science fiction. So he will be entering the world of authors and experts in just a little bit. Fascinating, fascinating information from the expert. So hang on and don't touch that dial, because I'm going to talk a little bit about politics and what's happening around the world, and then we will come back and interview our guest in just a bit. And what is happening around the world? Well, there's lots going on, apparently. And one of the issues is Alabama woman who joined ISIS is begging to come home. And there's a photo of her attacking a man with his hands tied behind his back. And the article states that is this particular woman. So, pretty serious decision there by the powers that be. And there's a lot of pushback against her returning to Western civilization. And then a rare video popped up, and it's Bernie Sanders. And on the video, Bernie Sanders is praising socialism. He's praising bread lines and food rationing, saying that this is a good thing for people to stand in bread lines and have food rationed. I doubt that he, as a wealthy man, and his wife will be standing in bread lines for food rationing. Very scary thought in the United States of America that there are people running for public office and in public office who want to turn America into a socialist nation and take what we earn and give it to the illegals, radicals, cartels, gang members, and eliminate the Constitution, sovereignty, legal immigration, and legal inspections by ICE and sheriffs and Border Patrol. They are totally anti-Border Patrol and ICE and law enforcement. And they don't believe that the people who storm through our borders illegally are should be held accountable for violating our laws or called criminals, even though illegal immigration is a crime. They also are criminals, in my opinion, because harboring illegals and criminals and terrorist cells inside the USA and using tax dollars to aid and abet them is a crime. So how many of them should actually be behind bars? That is a question blowing in the wind. And then there's a little entrepreneur, a little boy, and he is selling hot chocolate on his property. And he says the proceeds will help President Trump build the wall. What a little American patriot we have coming up, maybe even entering into politics in the future. This little boy was called Little Hitler by anti-Trump and anti-conservative and anti-constitutionalists for using hot chocolate, a hot chocolate stand, to raise money for a border wall to protect our citizens from criminals, terrorists, radicals, trafficking, organ harvesting, and so forth. Pedophilia, gang rapes, and theft. So we are a totally divided nation, it appears. But it appears, too, to me, after reading so much about what's happening in our country, that many Democrats are jumping off the socialist train and jumping onto the conservative train, especially after the Democrats decided that it's legal by signing a document stating that aborting babies at 9 months old, full developed babies at 9 months old, can be aborted, or if the abortion is botched, they can be left on a table to die without any care. We call ourselves a civilized nation, and we would condemn that in other countries. So it's difficult for Americans who grew up in this nation, who are natural-born citizens innate to our soil, who love our country, who love the Constitution that provides for the right to life and the right to oppose evil agendas that are unconstitutional, unlawful, and illegal, but the people in power can sign a document saying it is legal and force Americans to participate in the mass murder and genocide of natural-born Americans by diverting our forced to have our tax dollars diverted to agendas that kill off the natural-born Americans at birth, even fully developed babies, for profit and for taxes and depopulation, and for harvesting organs and human tissue and so forth. So our religious rights and our moral beliefs are unimportant any longer. It matters not. They're going to do whatever they're going to do because they have a pen and a piece of paper and a title. So last year there were over 43 million babies worldwide who were killed on abortion tables. And Americans are required under Obamacare to pick up the tab, not only for the babies that are being slaughtered on the abortion tables in this seamless assembly line of human commodities for human capital, but we're also required under Obamacare to pay for worldwide abortions of poor people in third world countries, especially Africa, where they overpopulate. And we are required to pay for those babies to be aborted to poor families on their soil, which is, if approved by their leaders who accept our tax dollars to implement mandated taxpayer-funded abortions in their countries under the guise of reducing poverty. Well, I guess if you slaughter enough babies who are needed to preserve nations, that absolutely you're going to reduce poverty in the world. And on that note, I'm going to take a break because when we come back, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts and go into the world of science fiction with our very special guest, Mark Kingston Levin, PhD. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him as soon as we come back. So don't touch that dial because you're not going to want to miss this story about time travel and about the 30th century escape, the 30th century revived, and the new book coming out soon, The 30th Century Contact.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best dessert. Try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you. But some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion? Not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics, from politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up, Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc, Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. We're back on Colombo Chronicles Live. You're listening to The Rose every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. And today we have a very special guest, and he is an award winner. He won the Irwin Award for the best science fiction book, 30th Century Escape. And he has a second book that's very exciting, 30th Century Revived. He's going to talk about those books. It's a trilogy, and he's going to let us know a little bit about his third upcoming book, 30th Century Contact. And just to give you a little bit of background, and we'll ask him to give us a little more about his background, I want to state that he worked on both the Apollo and Mars missions. He studied under the Nobel laureate Paul Dirac. He obtained his PhD in quantum mechanics in only 2.5 years. He has been published over 44 times in the scientific literature. And Dr. Levin founded two companies, and he was awarded over 32 patents. He retired in 2014 to apply his ideas about science, technology, space, and human relationships to the writing of science fiction. So lucky us, because everybody's interested in science fiction. It just takes us out of our world of reality. And so let's just say hello to Dr. Mark Kingston Levin. Hi, Dr. Levin. How are you today?
I am just fine. Thank you. And how are you?
Well, I'm doing good. I am excited because I think science fiction titillates everybody's brain, and they enjoy it. And so coming from an expert like you, it's really more exciting. So why don't you tell our audience, why did you pick the 30th century as one of the time frames of your trilogy?
Well, I think because I thought that's when we would have the most interesting technology of all, which even Stephen Hawking believed in, and that is warping space-time to change your time frame. Is that some people call that a time machine, it's what I think is most exciting in science today, is that it's possible. Einstein, there's nothing in physics that prohibits it, and Einstein's theory, general theory of relativity, allows it. So we just got to figure out how to do it, and it's not going to be easy. So I thought it would take probably almost 1,000 years or 900 years in that time frame before we perhaps have that technology. And it excited me to think about how we can do it. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because some people say, you know, that they can transport themselves. We read these stories where people actually say they can transport themselves, and other people believe that when you're asleep that you can transport yourself in your dreams, and other people, you know, write fictional stories like Star Trek, whatever, who transport themselves. Is that part of time travel?
Yes. Star Trek does a good job of it, but there are other people who've done it in the past, but I think in today's world it's much more science than fantasy. But I think, you know, if we go back 50 years, it was certainly fantasy, but I think today we're getting much closer to it. There are real scientists working on it, and it's become an acceptable area to work in science today. So I'm very excited about that, but mostly because it's not like, you know, trying to violate the second law of thermodynamics. Very difficult. This is something possible. So I think it's going to happen, and we're unfortunately not going to happen in our lifetime, probably, but it is going to happen. But you never know. Sometimes you get breakthroughs, and you know we're very surprised. I mean, the laser was an amazing breakthrough, and we were just lucky sometimes that we get these phenomenal breakthroughs. I think the Einstein's theory was a tremendous breakthrough, but nobody believed him. I think only 2%. In 1905, which is more than 100 years ago, Einstein said that the speed of light was constant, regardless if you were headed towards it or going away from it. It's not going to be any different. It's just going to be that, and nobody believed him. And we tested it, and you know, finally, we believed it because it's been tested thousands and thousands of times. So there are things that are not what you'd say. In quantum mechanics, there's many things that are not related to our world, because in quantum mechanics, things behave very funny. We used to call it weird, but there's double slit experiments and lots of other experiments just didn't fit the normal what you call logic, normal logic, because behavior is in some of these things depend a lot on the point of view of the observer, as Einstein's. That's why Einstein said everything is relative, because you know if you are looking at something and observing something, and it behaves differently than when you're not observing it. That is one of the mysteries of why we call quantum mechanics weird. They have some weird phenomena. And, I think we understand it pretty much because quantum mechanics has been developed a lot. But to the average person, it wouldn't make sense. And that's what we call, it's not intuitive to us. We have to learn it by experiment and by measuring, and then understanding that everything that happens on a large scale with things, objects, when I say large, I'm talking about the size of a pea. That's large. When you talk about the size of an atom or an electron, that's very large. So, but those small particles behave very differently than what you would expect from other particles. And it's because they're so small and have very different physics. The physics of their behavior is very different. And that's what quantum mechanics is. Newton worked out, how things work on a large scale, like planets or baseballs or cannonballs or small objects like a small coin or even a pea or something like that, dried peas. But anything that you would think of as just normal material. But when you get down to electrons, everything changes. They are half particle and half wave. And they behave differently depending on the circumstances, but they're repeatable. And science must be repeatable to be believable. So you just have to repeat these tests many times, and then you see the beauty in it, because it is beautiful. It's quantum mechanics was developed a lot by, say, a different generation of people. They're not alive today, like Dirac and Schrodinger and Max Born and some of these famous guys of the last century. It's just a beautiful. It's led to of course the Higgs boson, and it's a part of the Standard Model. I think we're very happy with that theory. It's the best theory we've ever developed, and if someday it's going to change, we're going to come up with a better one. But right now, it's the best.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, so, I know that you retired in 2014 and you started writing your science fiction books. And so at the age of 7, I read that you had the idea of space travel, and it fascinated you. What in your childhood actually caused you to be fascinated with space travel and science?
Well, my father was a doctor, and he kind of believed someday we'd go to the moon, and that was maybe in the early 40s, okay? My mother said, it's preposterous. we're not going to go there. And, of course, we did. But that was, about 45 or 46, a little argument in the family. And that changed my view, because I had to look for myself, and read Jules Verne's, and it sounded pretty logical. And when the movie came out, and it wasn't Jules Verne's, but it was a movie going to the moon, and I think it was about 1948. My mother told me not to go, but I went anyway. It's a small town, Burlington. I just walked down, went to the movie. You know, in those days, it was about 25 cents to go to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah, I just went in. You know, I was a young kid, and they let people in for 25 cents. I think adults had to pay a dollar, you know. but I went to it and saw it. I was very excited. So it got me interested, and that's why I went to work on the Apollo program. I was very disappointed. Werner von Braun, had a great plan for us going to Mars, including building nuclear rockets, which we had already built. We already tested at Jackass Flats. It worked. It was going to take us out of Earth orbit and all the way to Mars, and then back from Mars to Earth orbit again, where we would, of course, use different technology for landing. But the nuclear part would stay in orbit. And so for other missions, because the fuel doesn't run out. You have, it would last for 100 years, the nuclear.
Mm.
We were going to bring three of them. Von Braun suggested calling them the Pinto, the Nina, and the Santa Maria after Columbus's ships. Yeah. He wanted to name them the same as Columbus' ships. So, but he was a pretty smart guy. And he had already designed space stations with artificial gravity. And one of the things he wanted to do is first put up a space station, assemble these rocket systems for Mars in orbit. And you take up, a few components at a time using Saturn V. And Saturn I rockets, which are pretty really good lifters. You can take a lot of things in orbit. Congress at the time decided not to pay for it. So they cut back the program and used it on the Vietnam War or whatever, used it on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So, after you graduated from the University of Vermont and you worked on the Apollo and the Mars space missions, and you also were part of President Gerald Ford's science advisory team, how did all of that play into your outstanding career?
I think I learned a lot about Washington. It wasn't a really good place for people who wanted to do science or build products. But it was a great place for policy, and there was a key policy that I worked on. It had nothing to do with Mars, but it had to do with nuclear weapons. Ford, October 28th, I'm not even sure what year it was now, but I helped people write a statement that, at the time, we had enough uranium, we didn't need breeder reactors. So we didn't want to use plutonium in commercial. The main reason was because the Japanese had told us that if Taiwan and South Korea build nuclear reprocessing plants do that and build weapons for their own nation, you know.
So we
put pressure on them and told them that we were not going to approve this in our policy to have nuclear reprocessing for no reason, because there wasn't a need for more materials. So I think that was a good step. At the time, I got a lot of lobbying from the nuclear industry, which I really didn't like, because they were trying to bribe me, you know. I wasn't good.
That's what they do, don't they?
Yeah, they wanted to offer me these big jobs and stuff. You know, no, I wasn't going to change my position. But it was really up to Ford. It wasn't up to me. I just did a study, you know, for maybe I spent a couple of years at it, but it wasn't a full-time thing. But I was working on this study, and I had a lot of help from all these people who were really in the know about the resources of uranium. We had plenty of it, and we still have plenty of it. And we have about 100 reactors in the U.S., and, you know, there are probably not a lot of reactors built because of the safety issues. But I think the new reactors today are so much better than the old ones. You know, someday they may be replaced, but I don't know. But they are just much safer than they have been in the past. So I think there is, you know, some hope. But I think for military purposes, we continue to build new reactors. And, of course, they're much safer than the older ones, and that's a good thing. So we're replacing them. The new aircraft carriers have much better reactors. And as we move forward, I see, you know, less chance. You know, I don't really think it's a good idea to have nuclear weapons just because of the risk that somebody might use them. But we can't get rid of them, because then we'll be in a different position by small countries who get nuclear weapons. So we're kind of in a position of, damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And, you know, I kind of understood that, and I understood that's more of a political position. You have to take a political position for the strength of the United States. And by having them, I think we have avoided war with Russia, which could have escalated to nuclear war. But we were lucky that we both knew that we couldn't win a nuclear war. Nobody would win. And that kept us from doing it. And I think during the Kennedy administration was a very close time. We almost did it. Yeah. So,
wow. So scary.
Yeah, that was before me. Yeah. But I read about it and studied it and, you know, said we definitely don't want, you know, plutonium in commercial in the commercial world, you know, for everybody's buying and selling it, and you know, terrorists can buy it, anybody can buy it, and it just wasn't a good thing. And we got that out, and I think I'm glad I did that. But I'm much more interested in working on Mars program, you know, not working on that. But I was told to work on it, and that's what I did.
Okay. Well, we're glad you did. And so, Dr. Levin, you were awarded over 32 patents. What were the ones that were most intriguing to you? Because I found the one that where you devised an instrument to detect submarines under the ice extremely fascinating.
Yes. I didn't sell a lot of those because they're very expensive, but it used something called an EMP. It's a pulse which goes through the ice. If it hits metal, especially a heavy metal like iron, it will cause quadrupole magnetic resonance, and you can pick that up with a superconductor that's cooled to liquid helium temperatures. And it's common used now in MRI, it's called an MRI, but you have to have the pulse in order to detect the submarine under the ice. So you have to have this big EMP pulse. And as far as I know, that's still classified, the frequency and power of that pulse. But the other part, which is the niobium-10, what I used was niobium-10. They may use something that's higher temperature superconductors today. I don't know. That is just a tiny little coil. It looks like a spring, and it's in liquid helium, and the helium is pumped around. And when you make the pulse, and if there's heavy metals down there, it doesn't have to be iron, could be gold, you know, you would detect it. If it's moving, then you know it's probably a submarine, because gold's not going to move. And unless you have a gold submarine, that's probably not going to happen.
one wants to blow up a gold submarine.
No. But we didn't want to blow up Russian submarines either, but we wanted to keep track of them. Yeah, so
exactly.
It was more of a matter of how to position. What happened in, I forget what the year was. I think it was around 1967. That the Japanese, a company called Toshiba, sold turbines to Russia. They put them in their submarines, and we couldn't hear them, and we couldn't. They were so quiet with our normal detection system. The government was, what would you say? They wanted to find a solution to this problem. And you couldn't turn back, you couldn't put the genie back in the clock and tell the Japanese not to sell them because they already sold them a whole bunch. Obviously they can, what you call, reverse engineer it and learn how to do it. There wasn't any point. And so we had to come up with an alternate solution. One was to find a to measure the temperature and salinity and then calculate sound velocity. And so that's what we did, and I got lucky because the instrument to test for salinity and temperature I made and sold tens of thousands. And then I sold the company, and they sold, I think, 50,000 the first year.
My goodness.
Yeah, that became a big product, and you know it cost a lot of money. It was like $240 or something like that. That's cost. So you sell it for $500. You need a 50% margin, and so yeah, because you got to pay for all the R&D and everything, and so it became my biggest product, and that was the best one. That's why the company bought me. They were into sonobuoys, and in fact, they bought up not just me, but pretty much everybody else in the U.S. There's still a company in Canada, and Halifax, Canada, that makes these products. But in the U.S., Spartan Electronics is dominant, that company. So, but other things I made, which my professor, Dirac, would not work on weapons during the war, okay? He was very much for peace, okay? And even though he was told to, one reason I wrote this novel and the trilogy, it's all about a woman, about a heroine. Yeah, she's a woman who is nonviolent, and her organization is nonviolent, which has men and women in it. So they're called the SS, but it's a secret society of scientists, but they're nonviolent. And they don't kill people, they don't hit people, and they don't commit violence. So they feel that's civilized. In the 30th century, I think people will be civilized, and they won't do violence. They'll find other ways to get these things. So the only true victory is a nonviolent victory, because otherwise you just create more problems where somebody else wants to get back at you. So you have to... you have to find a way to negotiate. You have to find a way to compromise. You have to find, our government hasn't found the way yet. I mean, we have this terrible immaturity in Congress and in, well, I don't want to say, but in our government, let's put it that way. And we need to get
in Congress.
We need to get better. We need to move ahead of that kind of behavior. We need to come to more civilized behaviors. And I think that by the 30th century, they do. And that's what I wanted to express, that if we can be like that, we can have a much better life. And so you see in book two, we call it revived, because they actually go back in time in book one, and they change the defect, they correct the defect in the syndos, and then life becomes very civilized. So it may be something in genetics. We know that today, if we have an animal that is very, unable to tame an animal, that we can't really use that animal. It's not going to help
right.
us. But the Russians, they took the gray fox, which is a very vicious animal, and made it tame. And only in 50 years. So that was a phenomenal thing. I mean, it shows what would happen with the dog, the wolf. The wolf is a pretty aggressive animal. I don't think you want to put your hand out, let a wolf smell it, although some people have done it and lived. But
I don't think it's a good idea.
No, it's not a good idea. Wild wolves are wild animals, and they will bite. And although they are not terribly aggressive against humans, because I think they have an innate fear of humans, but nevertheless, we saw dances with wolves. I don't know if you remember that, but it
yeah.
showed uh-huh. that wolves are somewhat adaptable to humans, very much the way dogs are, but just a little bit slower. But there's something called a lone wolf, and lone wolves are wolves that generally been kicked out because they don't conform in some way. Maybe they're too tame, or maybe they're too skinny, or maybe they're the color's not correct. So because they will kick those who don't conform. And it was very interesting that the Russians, they found out that the gray wolf was no longer gray. That when they select, every generation you select for tameness, they get tamer and tamer, but the colors change.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, and they become, you know, a more variation in the species. So that was interesting, yeah.
Well, we're talking to Dr. Mark Kingston Levin, and he wrote a trilogy of books, 30th Century Escape, and the second book is 30th Century Revived, and the third book coming up is 30th Century Contact, and they're all science fiction, and he is an award-winning author. And I want to get more into your book, your books. I want to find out a little bit more about book number one, how it evolves into book number two, and then about your upcoming book. Can you stay with us?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment, so don't touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you. but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Listen up. We are talking to Dr. Mark Kingston Levin. He's wrote a trilogy of sci-fi books, award-winning books, and his 30th Century Escape took the best science fiction book of the year in the 2017 Irwin Awards, and he has an upcoming book, which will be the 30th Century Contact. So now he's going to tell us a little bit about his first book, 30th Century Escape, and how it evolves into the 30th Century Revive, which is his second book, and then he will tell us about his upcoming book, which is entitled 30th Century Contact. So let's say hello to Dr. Levin. Dr. Levin, are you there?
I'm here, yes, and I would be glad to tell you a little bit about the books. Well, first, I'll give you a setting where the environment is the 30th century. In the 27th century, they developed, in the 25th and 26th century, we sent lots of robots out to the nearby planets. Now they're like 40 years away by, if you're traveling at 0.1 times the speed of light, which is, we can't do that today, but by the 30th century, I think we'll be able to do that. And so we have this setting, and the people build a project to make humans. They think in the beginning they're going to make humans to be able to just travel through space. But they make some improvements and a few more improvements, and they're no longer people. They're not human. We call them syndos, and basically because they're synthetically manipulated. We call this technology embryo engineering, and you use a vector, which is a virus. It doesn't hurt the species, but will carry the information into all of its cells. And that's what we do for embryo engineering today with animals. And some people have done it on humans in China. At least one pair of twins had that procedure done that we know of. I think it's very exciting, because what we've done with animals is amazing. We've increased the lifespan of flies by 10 times, the lifespan of mice by a factor of 3, that means 3 times, and other animals at various different rates. But the important thing is we're learning how to do this without otherwise changing the genetics. Procedure may someday allow us to live 800 years. And in my 30th century novel, they live 800 years. I think they.
Is that without wrinkles?
Well, yes, it's without wrinkles.
All right.
What happens is they increase the health span so that you don't get these illnesses that we get. I mean, I had cancer several times. I don't have it anymore. I'm cancer-free. Because we developed technology, thanks to Johnson & Johnson. I'm going to make a pitch here. They developed something that saved my life. It's called Imbruvica. Okay, it's just one of their pills that they probably spent $1 billion or more developing. And it was pretty expensive when I was taking it, but it cured my cancer. So I'm very happy.
Wow. Very good.
I was pretty much going downhill all the way. There are biomarkers, and I was at 43 and a half, and when you're 50, you die. So that's a biomarker, just a kind of an average biomarker thing that they use. But anyway, that was a Waldenstrom syndrome, or it's a B-cell lymphoma for people who know cancer. But I think people are better off if they don't know cancer, because unfortunately, if you take... there's a guy at Harvard named David Sinclair. He and his team, he's originally from Australia, and he also has a lab in Australia. run by Dr. Wu, and they do a lot of great work. And he has reversed, he did a couple of years ago, aging in mice. And now he's working on getting that drug approved for humans.
Wow, that's amazing.
And the advantage, the advantage of this drug, which is NAD plus, they call it NAD plus, I won't bother with the full name because it's very long, but it's just a large chemical name. But it's actually a relatively small molecule as biomolecules go. But what it has done is reversed aging, and it's made mice that are like 90 years old humans into like 30 year old humans.
Wow.
You know, mice only live 3 years. They only live 3 years. So, it's made major, major changes, and he's trying to get it approved for humans. There's a problem because there's no, the FDA, not the, well, let's, yeah, I guess the FDA, but the National Institute of Health, they don't think that aging is a disease. It's a natural process. So they don't really have anything for that. So he has to first convince them that he can extend life so that you, before you age, okay, so you could take this and stop aging, essentially, because it's reversing aging, but you it prevents diseases like Alzheimer's disease and,
preventative medicine then.
Then it's preventative medicine, yes. Stops you from aging, okay? So
well, what's interesting about what you just said is that Obamacare is all about prevention. And so it would seem like that particular prescription
drug
would fall under that category.
I think it maybe would. It would, but he had trouble in the beginning because there was no money available to do something that, you know, is not been appropriated by Congress.
Oh,
you have to have these little
Congress.
It's got to be in this bucket. There's nothing there.
Give the older women in Congress a sample. They'll approve it.
Yeah, give them a sample. But anyway, he's moving forward, and he's going through FDA now. So, but it took a long time. I think it was among the geneticists and what would you say, maybe medical community. He's at Harvard Medical School, and he's a professor there in genetics. So what's happened is he's made an earth-shaking discovery. And not only, he reversed aging in mice, and he repeated it and used more and more mice, and, you know, it became pretty convincing data. And and what happens to those mice is that they will live longer without getting any disease, no cancer. You know, mice get cancer. They get Alzheimer's disease. They get other things. He proves that they have much better health during their period. And that's very important because our government would love to have an inexpensive way of extending your health span, which means, like in my 30th century book two, people live to be 800 years and they don't get cancer, they don't get any of these diseases, but when they hit 750 years, they start to go downhill. So they have a health span of 750 years. So that's average. And it would be great if we could do that. We don't have to live forever, but there's people in Russia, a very famous guy who started their kind of internet, who is putting up many millions of dollars. He's a billionaire, many millions of dollars to develop kind of like robots that will allow us to humans to take the mind of humans and put them into, he wants to do this within 2045 or 2050, that time frame, so that when your mind, you can preserve it in a computer, essentially, or a robot, but, you know, so that's a whole other approach. But his goal is immortality. And, you know, I really can't comment on it because I haven't done an analysis of his particular work, but that's the gist of it. And, he has a very short-term target. He wants to do it, like, you know, in 40, 50 years. I mean, that's an amazing thing if he could do that. But what's the guarantee that you really could capture your essence, your mind, and then put it into something, and it's you? Now, I just am a little skeptical, that's all. But, you know, scientists are supposed to be skeptical.
I can see why.
Yeah, okay. It promises immortality.
I don't know if somebody wants my mind, but okay.
I may want a new mind,
you know, and, you know, if I were to live another 50 years, I'd want a new mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is what he's trying to do. And that's kind of immortality,
right,
the way he sees it. Okay.
And in your 30th Century Revived book, though, you also say that your hero, Jennifer, that she brings down a whole network of terrorists. Is that part of this being healthier in the 30th century?
Yes. Now, what really is going back in time and resetting the clock. There was a defect in the Sindos. And it was due to her, she was actually adopted. It was due to her adopted grandfather, who actually was the guy who did the genetic engineering. He was ahead of the program. I can't say he did it all by himself. There were 200 people who created the Sindos using their own embryos. So from him, he didn't want any harm to come to the Sindos because they're his children, okay? He does everything he can do to help get Jennifer into the this organization. Her parents didn't want her to. I mean, she was adopted, but her parents, her adopted parents, they didn't want her to get involved. They wanted her to be involved more in saving animals because they were taking all their habitat, and that's a big problem. If you want to keep those animals to survive, you have to get more habitat for them. So the tendency in the 30th century is to build very tall buildings, so we can live in a condensed area and leave more land for animals, and that's her. Her mother's point of view. She has a strong point of view. But anyway, she joins, and eventually she becomes head of this organization because the head of the organization gets assassinated, and she takes over and finishes the project, finishes the machine, which was designed by her lover of 18 years. They were together 18 years, never got married, but they live 800 years. They're able to have children for hundreds of years, so it's not a problem at that time, but they did their thing. This is the way she thinks, but she's very sorry she didn't get pregnant because he died, and it was a big blow for her. And
we're running out of time. So what would you say to, I'm so sorry we're running out of time, but what would you
say
to your coming up book, 30th Century Contact, that people should watch for, and when do you think it will be coming out?
Well, it's going to come out February 22nd. That's Friday. Okay. It's already
fantastic.
Available for pre-orders on Amazon. Okay. It's available for pre-orders. You'll see it on the 22nd. So I'm pretty confident of that now. I'm very glad I could get that to you. But in the third book, we go to the 56th century because we discover that there's a pair of neutron stars that are orbiting each other. They're going to collide. When they do, they're going to destroy Earth and Mars. And we have to prevent that. So the only way you prevent that is to get there ahead of time with a spaceship. So we create, in the 56th century, a artificial intelligence, very, very superior. And so superior that it completes its job. It goes on a suicide mission and actually collides with one of the two neutron stars just to change the angular momentum so that the beam that comes out will miss Earth. And
Well, that's fantastic. It sounds really exciting. And so where can they – is Amazon.com the only place I can order your books, or do you have a website or social media?
I don't sell any of my books on my website. Amazon or Barnes & Noble or several other retailers will be available on.
Do you see a movie deal?
Well, I'm talking to some people who are going to write the script. Yeah. So it is a possibility. But they're using book two as the first and saving book three as a possible sequence. So book two is the very beginning of it. Jennifer writes a book for, which is science fiction as far as anybody's concerned, except for her. She writes it for her husband so that she can tell him where she's from, and she wants to bring him to visit her parents. So this is a part of book two. And but book three goes much further to the 56th century, and the technology is much more advanced. They have like technology which they can beam you from one place to another, just like they do in Star Trek. Although Star Trek's only supposed to be a few hundred years ahead of us, and I think it's going to take place much later, because that kind of technology is very difficult to develop. But the most exciting thing is this Bean, who's a computer, essentially a computer, a robot, but he has 20,000 robots working for him, in which he controls, because he has to go on a 5,000-year mission. And that's very far. And he develops a child. That's called That's the Two. And that's the very key character, because he's like a different kind of character, but he is a character, and he is one of the main characters. Jennifer is still the main character, but he's also nonviolent, and I shouldn't call him he, because he's sexless. It's not a he, it's an it.
Transhuman. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Kingston Levin. I wish you so much success with your books, your trilogy, 30th Century Escape, 30th Century Revive, 30th Century Contact, award winners. You can get them on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So go and pre-order so you be one of the first to get the 30th Century Contact trilogy number 3. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing so much information that really, you know, makes people stop and think about how the world is changing. And even though it seems like science fiction, there's a lot of truth in science fiction that, you know, appears to be coming to reality. And I wish you so much success with your books, and I hope to see it on the big screen too.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, and for having
You're
me.
So
Have
welcome.
A nice day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. And that's all we have time for, folks. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday with another very special guest. So God bless you, and God bless America. And we'll see what's happening as the world turns, right? Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or, if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.